Bill Cosby is seen from South Africa today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Sean Jacobs was a teenager in 1980 South Africa. He remembers when the idyllic Cosby Show appeared on TV.
Living in South Africa at the time, it was like tear gas, there's the tension. I think it was, at some level, it was a respite.
But how do South Africans feel about Bill Cosby now? We'll find out. Plus, a new fire detector designed to save lives in Cape Town's shacks.
As we say, these shacks, we always have the feeling that if the fire your house, you know your house can burn down. You always have the fear.
And a reporter posts a picture of an uneaten banana on Twitter, prompting a Somali tweet storm.
People are tweeting at me that they're like, you need to eat the banana. I actually had somebody tweet at me. It's like, need to eat the banana, white boy.
Those stories coming up today here on The World. A disgraced American icon, an icon with a global reach, Bill Cosby. His name is associated with numerous claims spanning many years by women who say they were drugged by Cosby and sexually abused by the actor. The details are sorted, and one case is now going to trial. Think back, though, to the 1980s, when his groundbreaking sitcom The Cosby Show was a hit here and, well, pretty much everywhere across the world, including South Africa. In fact, in the mid-1980s, during the height of repression by the apartheid regime, The Cosby Show was the most popular TV show among white South Africans. We wanted to start things out today by finding out what made Cosby so appealing to all South Africans in the 1980s and how South Africans see him today. Sean Jacobs is a black South African. He grew up during apartheid and watched The Cosby Show as a teenager in Cape Town. He now teaches in New York at the New School. Ron Krehbiel teaches at the University of Washington, Bothell. His book on the impact of media on the anti-apartheid struggle is called Starring Mandela and Cosby, Media and the Ends of Apartheid. Sean, let me start with you. Take us back to the mid-80s when you watched The Cosby Show in South Africa. What did you think about it at the time, and how popular and even available was it to non-white South Africans?
So I was probably, I think it's 1985 when the show first aired. So I must have been around, I think, 15 or something. And everybody was watching it once a week.
Whites and blacks.
Yeah, whites and blacks were both watching it. And I think what made it interesting is that this is a time when there was a state of emergency in South Africa. I was in high school. Black population in general were highly politicized. There was also a campaign to have sanctions against South Africa, and that campaign was beginning to focus on entertainment. So it's ironic that a show by somebody who was very explicitly opponent of apartheid, that his show was shown in South Africa. I think it was just interesting, on the one hand, to see a black family, you know, who's middle class, given that black South Africans also had aspirations. The father's a doctor, the mother, I think, is a lawyer. Now and then, the sort of outside world would disrupt this sort of idyllic setting. But in general, it's sort of like, you know, father and son, mother and daughter, mother and son, and the neighbors. So it's kind of like looking at a community, and living in South Africa at the time, there's like tear gas, there's the tension. When you watched it, it was something that was just out of sync with the world you were living in, and something that black South Africans in particular thought they could aspire to.
I mean, Ron Krehbiel, another irony is that Nelson Mandela at the time was persona non grata, as was his image. So South Africans probably knew Cosby better than they knew Mandela.
That's right. In the sense of Mandela was larger than life, but as an absence rather than as a presence, whereas you have the Huxtables, the family in The Cosby Show, who are present in a much more sort of intimate way, literally in the homes of the viewers, but also you are in the home of the Huxtables. It created this sort of perception that we can relate, we can understand, we know each other through that connection.
And Ron, I was shocked to learn that South Africa had no television service until 1976, and then it was the government channel, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, that would have been run by the apartheid government. They decided to offer The Cosby Show. Do you know what motivated that decision?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are a couple things going on there. So the reason there's no television until 1976 is because the apartheid regime is afraid of the impact television will have as a medium, not necessarily content specific. And then when satellite technology becomes powerful enough that it's clear that there's going to be the option of satellite technology, then the government says, okay, we want to at least be able to control this to whatever we can, whatever degree we can. In terms of the motivation for bringing The Cosby Show in, because it's entertainment, it's seen as innocuous, it's seen as undangerous. The ways in which African-American culture, art, music is highlighted in The Cosby Show in an American context is very, very clear. In a South African context, that can read very much as separate but equal. The Huxtable children go to historically black colleges. You know, occasionally a white family will enter the home, but it's relatively rare. And that centering of black American life actually reads not inconsistent with apartheid in some ways in the South African context of the 80s.
Well, Sean, there were some really direct connections to South Africa on The Cosby Show. There's a Free Mandela poster on the bedroom wall of Theo, the son. There was an episode with an appearance by Miriam Makeba, the great South African singer. And then there were the two grandchildren named Nelson and Winnie. What did South Africans think of these links? Did they even notice them?
I was trying to remember. I think when the episode with Theo, the son, in his bedroom, and there's a Mandela poster, when the door opens, they cut it so you couldn't see the poster. And if I remember well, I did not see that Miriam Makeba episode only after, you know, Nelson Mandela came out of prison in 1990. And similarly, the grandchildren, I mean, that's much later. That's, I think, in the early 90s.
So, Sean, bring us up to date. I mean, given that South Africa has such a high rate of sexual assault and rape, how have South Africans reacted to the many accusations against Bill Cosby?
I think like everybody else, I mean, people are generally shocked. I think people try to make a distinction between what is a character and what was a show in a particular moment in the 1980s. South Africa is also a country in which, you know, there's very high rates of sexual violence against women. And at one point, even the president was subject of a trial. I mean, he was found not guilty, although whether South Africans believe that.
That was a rape trial.
Yeah, whether they believe the outcome or think that the outcome was fair is another question.
Ron, take away all the sexual assault charges. What do you think would have been Bill Cosby's legacy in South Africa?
There's a lot of folks who would say, particularly white South Africans, who would say the impact on white South African attitudes towards black South Africans and sort of willingness to go towards the negotiation is that it was hugely profound, that it was one of the most significant things that happened. I tend to think those are overstated. I think the significance of the show lies more in its shared popularity, its shared cultural phenomenon. I think the other legacy is The Cosby Show really sets up and puts forward a very American style of what success looks like. And it's very individual, and it's very middle class, and it's very material, it's very consumerist, and it's very capitalist.
Yeah, Sean, I was going to ask you, can you draw a line between like social economic expectations of black South Africans today and the expectations set up by The Cosby Show? Like, middle class black family living in a Harlem brownstone means that you can live in a gated community in Joburg.
I mean, that's the truth in South Africa right now. One of the distinctive features of post-apartheid South Africa is a class apartheid, and it is one in which you have the retention of kind of white privilege. A section of the black population have joined that middle class, the gated communities and all the privileges, the old sort of schools that are inherited from apartheid, they send their children there. So a class apartheid is, I think, what is represented by The Cosby Show. There is a way in South Africa, in which particularly among the white population, there is a latching on to these kind of like sort of big narratives. So The Cosby Show can also be read within that sort of, with sort of easy solutions, but easy solutions which often coincide with very much a kind of a capitalist view of the world.
Sean Jacobs watched The Cosby Show growing up in Cape Town, South Africa. He now teaches at the New School in New York. Ron Krable is the author of Starring Mandela and Cosby. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
For South Africans who have not experienced upward mobility, this next story is a bigger concern to them than the legacy of Bill Cosby. In slums across South Africa, fires are a frequent worry. A single fire can sometimes displace thousands of people. So a group of young South African inventors came up with an early warning system that's already heading off serious blazes, and it all started with a classroom challenge. Sarah Birnbaum reports from Cape Town.
I arrived in Cape Town around Christmas time when the winds really start to pick up. The first time I turned on the radio, I heard about a township fire nearby that left thousands of people homeless in one night. I was shocked by the magnitude of the loss. But then every day, it seemed like there was another shack fire.
Many were asleep when the fire raged through the informal settlement.
Three people have died in two separate shack fires.
Another fire at KT section at Khayelitsha on the Cape Flats left nearly 100 people homeless. This brings to nine.
Patricia Kala lost her home and everything she had in a fire in Masifumelele Township in December. It was the third time that happened.
Yeah, this was the third time now.
Kala says when you're poor here, fire is a constant threat.
You always have the feeling, as we say in these sheikhs, you always have the feeling that if the fire your house, you know your house can burn down. You always have the fear.
Millions of South Africans live in these kinds of neighborhoods. Shacks built of zinc, wood, plastic, and cardboard, one right up against the other, so fire spreads easily, especially with the winds and widespread use of candles and paraffin stoves. A couple of years ago, an electrical engineering professor at the University of Cape Town had enough. He asked his students to come up with a low-cost alarm system for shack dwellers. Francois Potusi took up the challenge.
For me, that was the reason I was an engineer. That was the reason I wanted to work in this field, was to do things that could benefit society and people in any way.
Most Americans have smoke alarms, but Potusi says you can't use them in a shack settlement because ceilings are low and people use open flames for cooking, heating, and lighting. So Potusi developed a small device that would sense a rapid rise in temperature over a short period of time.
So not, you know, cooking or anything like that, but like a drastic change, like the hundreds of degrees that can change in the event of a fire.
Potusi's alarm would have remained a school project if not for a terrible fire in 2013 in Cape Town's largest slum. The flames left 6,000 people homeless on New Year's Day.
There was actually one of my close friends, Emily Vining, who came to me in tears and was like, "We must deal with this challenge. You've started something. Let's take this forward and actually make this into something real that can actually affect people."
Potusi and his friend formed a company. They later called it Lumkani, which means beware in Xhosa. They started testing the alarm and realized the prototype only went so far.
This device, it actually needs to alert more than just the person living there, because it is a community-wide challenge. When one fire starts, it is the community's problem as much as it is yours.
So Potusi installed a chip inside the device that receives and transmits a radio signal, and it's wirelessly networked to all the other Lumkani devices in the area.
And basically, that means that you can actually create a whole community-wide alert. That means that every single home who has a fire detector can know, there's a fire within my neighborhood.
There's also a central device that sends text messages to residents and GPS coordinates to the fire department. Today, Lumkani has 7,000 blue alarms in the field in Cape Town, Pretoria, and Johannesburg. And Potusi and his partners say they've already helped stop what could have been 9 major fires. Right now, Lumkani is funded by charitable donations, with consumers paying a small fee, about $1.30 per box. But they're looking for a more sustainable business model, and they're hoping to expand throughout South Africa and beyond. For now, Patricia Kala in Masafumalele has a Lumkani alarm in her current home. And she's cautiously optimistic that when the next fire hits, she'll be prepared.
If the alarm goes off, then we can save things and maybe we can save other houses also. Yeah, we're waiting to see.
For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, Cape Town, South Africa.
We have a video up on our Tumblr that explains how these devices work. You got to see it at pritheworld.tumblr.com. This is The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
Every year, reporter Hannah Baba goes on a field trip with her daughters. Hannah is Sudanese-American and lives in Union City, California, just outside San Francisco. The field trip is meant to immerse the kids in their parents' language and in Sudan's music and culture. They join other families on a bus ride that is anything but ordinary. Here's Hannah's story.
20 kids and 15 adults pack a yellow school bus. The Sudanese parents talk in Arabic. Their kids are being rowdy in English. As we settle in, two women pick up drums, another a tambourine. Now, on most field trips in the U.S., kids sing campfire songs. You know, Bingo was his name-o. Not today, yo. Here, the moms are warming up because they'll do the singing and clapping and the ultimate Sudanese joyful noise called the zagaruta. These kids are U.S. born. Many go to Sudan maybe for a month or two every year or so, not enough to really connect to their roots there. So these trips try to replicate life in Sudan so that even the kids tuned out with their headphones on might absorb something today. The songs the moms are belting out are from their youth, when they were in Sudan. They're mostly about guys, love, and tunes from a Sudanese wedding ritual called the Sera. It's when the groom and his family take a bus to the bride's house. Parent Manahe Le Sheikh describes the ritual this way.
Oh my God, it's a party atmosphere. All the neighborhood just get in the bus and have a good time until we get to the bride's house.
Okay, let's see if any of this registers with the kids. They're in the back of the bus. Sara Bashir, who is 9, is clapping along. She says trips like this give her a sense of belonging.
Because, you get to more and more of your culture people.
But some of her culture people aren't as enthusiastic. Student Shahid Hamid isn't feeling the purpose of this trip. She's not into the wedding ritual songs. She thinks it's just people showing off.
Because, they're always trying to open the windows, trying to make people look at them and stuff like that. I don't even know why. Tell them, our son is so-and-so. He's getting married. Look at our son. This is our son. He's getting married.
Still, the women keep on. Then there's a sound from the back of the bus. Are the kids joining in? It's them, but they're singing the Little Einstein's theme song. Not quite Sudanese, but to these parents, any engagement today is a plus. Manahe Le Sheikh says most of the kids get the point of this trip.
One day they're going to remember that my parents, my teacher, they brought all this culture to us. And when they grow up, they're going to appreciate it one day.
But just to make sure, as Sheikh starts tossing handfuls of candy towards the kids, reenacting another wedding ritual, the jirtik, where the groom throws candy at the guests.
The elder believe that will take the devil away from them. It's kind of fun for the kids, and wish them to have a happy moment.
Now things start to really click. And the kids connect with Sudan without having to travel thousands of miles. Instead, it's happening here on a yellow school bus crossing the San Francisco Bay. For the world, Hannah Baba, San Francisco.
Okay, I'm a little reluctant to do stories about bananas causing controversy, but I couldn't resist when I read this line. Here's the story of the biggest mistake I ever made with a banana. That sentence was written by Matt Pierce of the Los Angeles Times. He was on assignment for the paper in Minneapolis, working on a story about three young Somali Americans charged with trying to join the Islamic State. So he set out to find out more about the Somali community in Minneapolis.
The very first stop, as I was sort of trying to dip my toe into the pool, so to speak, was at a family restaurant right in the heart of Cedar Riverside in Minneapolis, which is the heart of the Somali immigrant community there. Minneapolis has a very large Somali immigrant community, and that's where my banana crisis happened.
Yeah, so what happened?
So I ordered a plate of basmati rice and lamb, and when the guy brought it out, he also came and brought out a banana and set it on the table alongside the plate. And, I'm kind of looking at this, and I've never had Somali food before. I hadn't Googled it before I came because I just stopped by. And, I'm not a food critic. I'm not very good with food, honestly. I don't cook much. And honestly, I thought a banana was self-explanatory, which was my gravest mistake. So I tweet out this photo of the plate, of the meal. And I kind of add in another tweet, somebody asked me what the food was. And I was like, oh, yeah, and the banana was brought as an appetizer. And that was my guess. And Somali Twitter went nuts. I mean, this thing, my tweets got retweeted hundreds of times. I got tweeted at hundreds of times.
How fast was the reaction online?
It started building up over a couple of days. There was kind of a quick instant response from, I think, a few Somalis who have followed me on Twitter, but slowly it started to pick up mass. And so about a day later, things really started to get moving. And I was just getting tweets from Somalis from all over the world, not just Minnesota, but also Toronto, London, elsewhere. And wow. It was basically the Somali diaspora.
What were the key hashtags, like Somalia and banana?
Yeah, well, pretty much. I mean, the people are tweeting at me that they're like, oh, they're hungry, or like, oh, you know, I'm missing my mom's cooking. And they're like, you need to eat the banana. I actually had somebody tweet at me. It's like, this is triggering. You need to eat the banana, white boy.
that was the quote.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was interesting, you know, because it was clearly I had committed a faux pas. I had misunderstood what the banana was for in the meal. And the banana, it turns out, is a staple of Somali cuisine. You can eat it with pretty much everything, with rice, with pasta. You're supposed to slice it up and eat it with the rice. So it's something that you actually unpeel, you know, as you start the meal and slice it up. Then you just take bites with banana and rice. But there's this other component to the story that, you know, this wasn't just about food, but it was also about the nature of Somali culture itself and the way that young Somalis and the older Somalis too preserve their culture through food, because they've been scattered all around the world because of the civil war there.
Did you find out how and why bananas became part of Somali dining?
I did not. A lot of this I get through tweets. You know, someone tweeted to me that it's actually a little bit more of a staple of Somali cuisine in the south rather than the north. But the thing that I sort of heard over and over again was, because I was hearing from younger people, that their relationship with the food wasn't really historical. It was more about their families. You know, it's about the way that their mother prepared the food, or how, you know, if they were a refugee, how their mother had used food, or their parents had used food to preserve Somali culture inside of the home.
So, Matt, do you have plans now to eat Somali rice the right way with the banana sliced into it?
Yeah, you know, we've got a Somali restaurant. I was just reading about it in Inglewood here in L.A., and I think I'm probably going to go pretty soon so I can actually taste what it's like, because I'm told that when you eat the banana properly with the rice, it's heaven on earth.
Matt Pierce is a reporter with the L.A. Times, telling us how he discovered that sliced bananas ain't just for breakfast cereal. Just ask a Somali. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Hmong call it the gutsia. It's a kind of song poem, and a Hmong daughter in Minnesota is carrying on her father's tradition.
I think for so many little immigrant refugee children like us who belong to men like him, songs like the gutsia call us home and raise us up.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Tomorrow will be a big day, or at least a highly symbolic day, for U.S.-Japanese relations when President Obama visits Hiroshima, the first sitting U.S. president to go to this city, which, of course, was all but destroyed by an American atomic bomb in 1945. The upcoming visit reminded us that shortly after taking office, President Obama outlined an ambitious plan to rid the world of nuclear weapons in a speech in Prague. That vision helped him win a Nobel Peace Prize. He has not met that goal, but how much has he accomplished in at least containing nuclear weapons? Matthew Bunn has some answers. He's with the Project on Managing the Atom at Harvard's Belfer Center. To start with, he says there are fewer nuclear weapons in the world today than there were when Obama took office in January 2009.
Both the United States and Russia, who have more than 90% of the world's nuclear weapons, have continued to reduce their stocks of nuclear weapons, though slowly. President Obama has made some major progress on controlling nuclear dangers with a new nuclear arms agreement with Russia and with a breakthrough agreement with Iran and with a series of summits focused on security for nuclear weapons and materials so that they don't fall into terrorist hands, which provoked a good deal of improvement around the world in security for nuclear material. But almost all of the rest of what he hoped for in the Prague speech in 2009 remains unaccomplished and undone. So we have no progress on a comprehensive test ban. We have a nuclear arms race in South Asia between India and Pakistan that is very dangerous. We have North Korea expanding its nuclear arsenal in a very dangerous way. We have actually greater nuclear danger between the United States and Russia than we've had in a long time. No progress toward ending the production of nuclear material for nuclear weapons, which was another element of the Prague speech. No real progress toward strengthening the global regime for preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. So there's a lot of work still for the next president to do.
Those are a lot of counterweights to the positives that you listed. Does that kind of zero out Obama's successes?
I don't think so. I think the successes are real and they're important. But the world has proved to be more resistant to change in nuclear postures than Obama expected when he came to office.
What about proliferation? Have any new nations acquired the bomb during Obama's tenure? And for that matter, have any nations relinquished the bomb?
Well, as I mentioned, we have this deal with Iran that greatly reduces the chance that Iran will get nuclear weapons for the next 10 or 15 years. But then many of the important restraints in the deal phase out. But no new states have gained nuclear weapons. There are now more states that started nuclear weapons programs and gave them up than there are states with nuclear weapons. So our efforts to talk countries out of it succeed more often than they fail, even in those relatively rare cases when states start down that road in the first place.
In the meantime, I'm reading that the United States is ramping up a new class of nuclear sub that will ensure nuclear deterrence through 2080. Can the U.S. have a non-nuclear world without its own nukes to deter more nukes?
Well, what President Obama said is that we will seek the safety of a world free of nuclear weapons, but we'll maintain a safe, secure, and reliable deterrent in the meantime. And unfortunately, most of the effort since then has been focused on the safe, secure, and reliable deterrent part. It's an amazing irony of history that the president who won a Nobel Peace Prize for his soaring disarmament rhetoric is also the president who has laid out literally a $1 trillion program over the next 30 years to modernize every aspect of the U.S. nuclear arsenal to last essentially forever.
Is that a paradox that we'll always have as long as we have an atom?
There are those who believe that. I don't believe that. I think that one can at least imagine the circumstances in which it would make sense to move toward eliminating nuclear weapons. Those circumstances don't exist today, but I think over time it may be possible to build systems of international security and of verification and arrangements that would leave some capability that could be reconstituted if anybody cheated, so that you could have a world without nuclear weapons that was more secure than the world with nuclear weapons.
I got to say, that's a very encouraging answer.
Well, it's my answer. I don't expect that it's going to be here tomorrow. But I think I can at least imagine that world. People say, well, you know, how could you possibly imagine that India and Pakistan would ever get rid of their nuclear weapons? And, you know, India and Pakistan didn't exist as nation states 70 years ago. So I think it's to say never can these conflicts be resolved represents a sort of failure of imagination.
Matthew Bunn with the Project on Managing the Atom at Harvard's Belfer Center. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Cambodia and that country's struggle with its own historical memory. The Khmer Rouge regime killed an estimated 1.7 million people there during the 1970s. The trauma of that genocide runs deep and affects politics both in Cambodia and in Cambodian communities around the globe. When the current prime minister's son toured North America last month, he was met by protesters wherever he went. My WGBH colleague Rupa Shenoy reports from Lowell, Massachusetts, home to one of the largest Cambodian communities in the U.S.
The scene outside the restaurant where Hun Manet spoke was raucous. Police lined the road. A helicopter buzzed overhead. Protesters shouted through bullhorns and hoisted signs. They accused Manet of silencing opponents and having blood on his hands. But in a videotaped interview with the local newspaper's editorial board, he says he doesn't understand why anyone would say such things.
I do not understand the real objective of the organizers.
Manette's a West Point graduate and son of Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, who took power after the Khmer Rouge regime. Manette says 30 years later, Cambodia is a peaceful democracy with a growing economy and middle class.
People have TVs, some areas have vehicles.
Protesters see a different Cambodia, one ruled by a dictator, Manette's father, who jails dissidents and rigs elections. Champa Pang says she has a duty to do what people in that Cambodia cannot.
I just pictured all these people in Cambodia that are still suffering and needed our voice to stop Hun Manette and stop Hun Sen at all costs.
Pang, who was born in the States, says since the protests, photos of her and other demonstrators have circulated on Facebook with their faces crossed out. It all has a sinister feel. Pang feels threatened. That's why she hasn't told her mother she was involved in the protests.
Because it will bring so much trauma. My mother lost children in the war to Khmer Rouge. And we know who Hun Sen represents. He was Khmer Rouge. And so to tell my mother that I'm going up against Hun Sen and Hun Manette, she would die.
Images of the atrocities in Cambodia still haunt and drive many of the survivors. Survivors like Camera K. He helped convince the Lowell City Council to denounce Manette's visit.
I remember seeing bodies with a blue grocery bag wrapped around their head, suffocated in a rice field and left to die. I have to accept what I saw and appreciate what I have and continue to advocate for the better future.
Kay is running for election against the highest-ranking Cambodian-American politician in the U.S., Lowell State Representative Rowdy Mom, in part because he thinks Mom is too soft on the current Cambodian government. Kay says he feels betrayed by Mom because he's met with Hun Manette and doesn't speak out against him.
The feeling of the community is that Representative Mom is a sympathizer to the regime.
Kay's community, at least. Mom says he represents another point of view, and he emphasizes he has every right to his opinion. After all, he survived the genocide himself. As a child, he worked tending to Communist Party members' cows and lived in a refugee camp.
I know what it's like to have no freedom, to exist and not knowing whether you're going to live or die, but to only have fear. I know that. I know their pain and struggle.
But unlike the protesters, Mom advocates leaving that struggle behind. He thinks Cambodia is improving, perhaps slowly, but Cambodian Americans should give it time and leave Cambodia to Cambodians who live there.
Cambodian politics has nothing to do with how we lived here. They can fight among each other. We are American.
And to Mom, being American means looking forward and concentrating on how to make the United States a better place. To Champa Pang, Camera K, and other protesters, being American means using their freedom to advocate for change everywhere. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Lowell, Massachusetts.
Not much change in Yemen, a story we've been closely following since a civil war began there a year ago. More than a month ago, a ceasefire began that could provide a little hope for Yemenis suffering through that war. Though the fighting continues in some parts of the country, the warring parties have spent the past month in an on-again, off-again attempt to settle differences. Right now, it's on-again with sit-down negotiations this week in Kuwait City. On Monday, we reached a former ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Feierstein, now a senior official with the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. Ambassador, what do you think Yemen will be like once this war is over?
Well, I think that when the war is over, when we are able to resume the political transition, I hope that there will be in place a political dialogue and a basic understanding of how to move forward on the political track. And at the same time, of course, we and the Yemeni people and the international community are going to face a huge requirement to try to rebuild the country, stabilize the humanitarian situation, and try to begin to build a stronger and more sustainable economic future for the Yemeni people.
So that's your hope, but basically in three sentences or less, how did we get to this situation?
The good news is that the Yemeni people came together in 2011 and 2012 and agreed on a process for the political transition and also a way to resolve many of the longstanding issues among Yemenis. Nevertheless, the political environment never really coalesced in a way that allowed for the success. And unfortunately, elements within Yemen decided that they were going to try to accomplish through violence what they were not able to achieve through political negotiation.
That's Gerald Feierstein, the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. Let me get the world's Stephen Snyder into the mix here. He set up the interview with the ambassador. And Stephen, you're the one in the newsroom who keeps our eyes trained on Yemen. Why is the ambassador talking about things that happened 5 years ago?
Well, that's the last time that the factions in Yemen were actually talking to each other. 2011, 2012, those were very hopeful years. It was right after the Arab Spring. Yemen was the one country where a dictator had agreed to step down instead of being forced out. And President Obama himself was saying that Yemen was the model for settling conflicts. But as we all know, things kind of fell apart.
So what went wrong?
Well, this is what everybody's talking about. I reached out to Yemenis on social media, and they wrote to me with some very strong opinions. There's a Yemeni scholar here in the U.S. Her name's Neda Eldossari. She agrees with the ambassador that some groups ditched the political process and set the stage for war. But she also blames the U.N. and Yemeni negotiators for allowing the former dictator Ali Abdullah Saleh to hold on to power even though he lost the presidency. Many of the people who wrote to me said the U.S. is backing the wrong side in the war. They say that rebels who took control of the country are bad, but the efforts to kick those rebels out are destroying the country. There's been more than 3,000 civilians killed so far in the last year. That includes 900 kids.
Wow.
And mostly, Marco, these Yemenis wonder why the U.S., which they look to for help, is supporting the Saudi-led bombing campaign and naval blockade against the rebels.
Former Ambassador Feierstein has something to say about that. Let's hear that part of the interview.
I think that there are a number of misunderstandings and misrepresentations of the Saudi position. The reality is that we and the Saudis agreed on the basic principles that we were trying to accomplish, which was, in fact, the restoration of the political transition. And so we have been working closely with the Saudis in trying to accomplish that. What has happened over the course of the conflict has been absolutely tragic for the Yemeni people, and yet it's a mistake to try to implicate the Saudis as the responsible party for that. The Saudis, along with the rest of the international community, have supported the legitimate government and have supported the legitimate and agreed upon political transition in the country.
Now, that word legitimate is used a lot, but just how legitimate any leader in Yemen is can start some really big arguments. Yemenis will debate the value of the Saudi-led bombing campaign, and they argue about the negotiations going on right now in Kuwait City. But one thing, though, the Yemenis agree on, that the suffering really has to stop.
Right, and former Ambassador Feierstein nodded to that, too, when he spoke with us.
Really, the most immediate issue is the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and the need to complete a process that started 5 years ago with the Arab Spring of political transition and a way of bringing Yemen into a period of greater security, stability, and hopefully economic prosperity.
That's former Ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Feierstein, speaking with us from the U.S. State Department. You can read more thoughts from the ambassador on Yemen and what more than a dozen Yemenis said in response at PRI.org. The World's Stephen Snyder, thanks very much for bringing us this story.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And this is The World. Tomorrow, President Obama arrives in Hiroshima. An estimated 140,000 people died when the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city back in August of 1945. It's still unclear whether Obama will meet with some of those who survived the bombing. Yoshiko Kajimoto is one of those survivors. She was 14 years old at the time.
I was working in a propeller factory, and I saw a flash of blue light suddenly, and I thought, oh, it's a bomb coming down. So I covered my eyes, ears, and nose, and ducked down under the machinery. Then after a while, I regained consciousness with the cry of help from a friend nearby, and it was pitch dark.
Kajimoto was injured. She says she had shards of glass in her arm, and she didn't eat for 3 days.
What I can remember was the third day when we went to that place for the people wounded, and I was given black rice balls. That was the first food I remembered. But everybody asked me, you must have had something like a dry biscuit. But I don't remember anything until that rice bowl was given.
Although she managed to survive, other members of her family, including her father, did not. And even now, more than 70 years later, the day of the bombing is still very much with her.
I don't have a nightmare while I was asleep about atomic bomb, but when I hear alarm or siren during the day, that frightens me sometimes.
For a long time, Kajimoto says, she held a grudge.
The people who dropped the bomb and ordered bomb, or person who made the atomic bomb, must have known consequences, how powerful it was. So I hated and I had a grudge against them because it's not inhumane. They wouldn't have used it if their families in a danger. So at that time, I really hated them.
But now?
Now I only wish world peace. And now I've grown up and I know America is not the only to blame, because now I know Japan did some terrible things in Asia and we are the one to blame for that as well. So everybody did terrible thing. That's the nature of war. So what we have to do is apologize to each other and reconcile.
Hiroshima survivor Yoshiko Kajimoto there, speaking with our colleagues at the BBC. She says she hopes President Obama will decide to speak to survivors like herself during his visit. And finally today. The style is known as gutsia, or song poetry. It's performed by Hmong immigrant Biya. While new to most ears in the U.S., the meaning of gutsia songs is not that hard to understand. Just think of it like the Laos version of the blues, or as American writer Ralph Ellison explained it, a way to lyrically chronicle personal catastrophe. Ellison's quote starts off a new book about Biya and song poetry. It's by Biya's daughter, Go Kaliaya. It's called The Song Poet, A Memoir of My Father. Kalia, where does the tradition of gutsia actually originate?
It belongs to us, the Hmong. My father, my aunts and my uncles, my grandmother, they're all well-versed in it. It's an expression of emotion and story and history and life, death.
How old is it? Like, how many centuries back?
I think as old as the Hmong people are, and there's not a lot about us in history. We can be traced back to the lowlands of China, a culture that I'm pretty sure dates way back when. But our written language was taken away from us, and it wasn't until the 1950s that the Hmong in Laos, a French missionary devised a written Roman script for the Hmong. And so our language has been transferred into flowers on our clothing, so we have a language of flowers.
Mm, that is beautiful. So you invoke Ralph Ellison with this quote that, like the blues, gutsia is a way to lyrically chronicle personal catastrophe. How would you describe the personal catastrophe of the Hmong?
As a child of the Hmong people, I know that we come from a war. Growing up in America, I never learned which war we came from, because in history classes, we only learned about the Vietnam War. It was between the Americans and the North Vietnamese Army. To belong to a people that has been deleted so thoroughly from history, I think is terribly sad. My father and other traditional Hmong gutsia singers have tried to document this in their songs, the stories of how a war came upon a people, how lives were lost, and how we've stood up again.
I mean, like the blues, like any music of suffering, it's said to be soothing for the soul. What does gutsia do to your soul when you listen to it?
It connects me to my dad, who is a song poet in the Hmong tradition. Everybody in America knows him as, you know, for most of my life, I've talked about my father as a machinist. But I know that in his heart and in mine, he's a song poet in my tradition. So when I hear gutsia, I think about the man who, long before I'd ridden a bike or a car, I saw the world from his shoulders. It was those shoulders that took me to the tops of the trees and said, one day your little hand and your feet, you know, will not dictate your life journey. You will walk on the horizons your father has never seen. When I hear gutsia, I think about his words and I think about the future that he saw for me. To him, I've never been a child of poverty, war, and despair. I had always been hope being born. He said, the captain to a more beautiful future. And I think for so many little immigrant refugee children like us who belong to men like him, songs like the gutsia call us home and raise us up.
So do you see yourself, Kalia, carrying on the tradition of Gutsia, and how do you adapt it and keep it relevant today in 2016?
I think the song poet is a definite adaptation, particularly because Gutsia is not written, and so it's sung. I don't have my father's voice. You cannot just be a good Gutsia singer. You have to be born with a gift because your voice is the only music accompanying your words into the world. I come from a tonal language where every breath carries meaning. In English, you know, every word in my lungs, I have to wrap it around. I feel like I have to sculpt rock into shape to make meaning to a bigger world. So I unfortunately cannot sing the way my father does, but I believe that the book is my contribution to the form.
Kalia, what would be lost for you if Gutsia were to be gone for good?
The history of the Hmong people, the beauty of our language. We have a beautiful language. You know, our words have had to, they've had to carry the power, the ability to write on memory. All of that would be gone. The depth of the poetry. I know simple Hmong words. I know how to say, simple Hmong words. But my father and the depth of his understanding of the language, if we didn't do Gutsia anymore, that would all be lost.
Guk Kalia Ya is the author of the new book, The Song Poet, A Memoir of My Father. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
And that is her father, Hmong song poet Bi Ya, performing Young Lovers. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.